needs do as a human being. At the first real wedding I ever attended, I was the bride. I never dreamed of getting married when I was young. I hadn't really wanted to. In high school, girls fantasized about big, poofy dresses and Long Island weddings, while I visualized a dream of becoming a successful musician and actress. That's all I cared about. So it was pretty ironic that I ended up having one of the decade's most lavish New York weddings in one of the decade's most dramatic, voluminous gowns. Apart from the ambition, Tommy and I were completely different, and the black part of myself caused him confusion. From the moment Tommy signed me, he tried to wash the, quote, urban, translation, black, off of me. And it was no different when it came to the music. The songs on my very first demo, which would become my first smash album, were much more soulful, raw, and modern in their original state. Just as he did with my appearance, Tommy smoothed out the songs for Sony, trying to make them more general, more universal, more ambiguous. I always felt like he wanted to convert me into what he understood, a, quote, mainstream, meaning white, artist. For instance, he never wanted me to wear my hair straight. I think to him, it didn't look naturally straight. It looked straightened. He thought it made me look too, quote, urban, translation, black, or R&B like Faith Evans. Instead, he insisted that I always wear my loose and bouncy curls, which I think he thought made me look almost like an Italian girl. Though, ironically, my curls are a direct result of my black DNA, assisted by a good small barrel curling wand to integrate the frizz. My curls had certainly crisscrossed with Italian culture before I met Tommy. I did live in more than a dozen places on Long Island. In the 11th grade, I attended a beauty tech school. I was there mostly to kill time before I became a star, my only career goal. It was more creative, entertaining, and practical than regular high school. I'd always struggled with pulling a cohesive look together. There weren't any of the tools or potions at home for me to play with, and I certainly didn't have a consistent crew of girls to go through the passage from girl to teen with. There was a real allure to gaining more refined beauty skills. Also, I was a huge fan of the musical film Grease growing up. I thought I could have my own Pink Ladies moment, and I kind of did. My beauty school class was made up of mostly Italian girls. There were mean girls, there were shy girls, there were regular girls, and then there were the girls. They were a clique of about three or four fabulous ones who, comparatively, of all the girls I'd ever seen on Long Island, were the most glamorous, or rather, they seemed to be having the most fun with it. But they were so serious about their look. Subtlety to these girls was a waste of time and flavor. They were terminally tanned. Their heavily highlighted hair was coiffed within an inch of its life, every ringlet, puff, and bang sprayed into obedience. Their makeup was bright, flashy, and perfectly applied. They wore their fingernails long and did. Some even had nail art, a line of tiny gold studs or their initials in crystals on a perfect, thick, bright white French major. We all had to wear a uniform of a drab maroon button-up smock with white pants and hideous chunky white nurse shoes. But these girls would not have their flamboyance hidden. They wore their smocks open, revealing the leggings and boys' ribbed white tank tops with fancy, lacy bras they featured underneath. And of course, there was the jewelry, thick and thin gold-linked chains in flat herringbone and rope styles with Italian horns, crosses, and initial pendants dangling from them layered on their necks, hoops in their ears, and delicate gold and diamond rings on every finger. They were so adult to me. They were obviously already having sex, obviously not only because they carried their bodies in a particular way, but because they let everybody know it. They talked easily and openly about sex, which was secretly shocking to me. They called themselves Guidettes, and I had no idea what that meant, but I thought it was cool they had a name, like a singing group or something. They would roll up to the beauty school in flashy cars, bumping WBLS, the urban dance radio station. Oof, they only knew we called it the Black Liberation Station. Loud. And of course, I knew every song and would sing them, like Jocelyn Brown's Somebody Else's Guy. I quite enjoyed laying into the big, slow vocals at the beginning. Or, Ain't Nothing Going On But The Rent by Gwen Guthrie. The girls loved it, and my teacher hated it because I was always singing, blowing out notes rather than doing blowouts. It was my singing and constant popping of jokes that won these flashy teen princesses over. Because I was from another school, and I hadn't formed my own confident look, I was not quite cool clique material. We did manage to do each other's hair. Surprisingly, no one ever questioned me about my mixed texture, the thickness or thinness of my lips, or any of my features. I learned a lot from those girls. They helped me bring more volume and energy to my hair and more gloss to my lips. We had more in common than one would imagine. There's always been an underground relationship between hip-hop and the mob in pop culture. We especially loved the style and swag of movies like The Godfather and Scarface. Later, I recreated the hot tub scene with Jay-Z for the Heartbreaker video. That video will always be one of my favorites. I enjoyed playing homage to Elvira, Michelle Pfeiffer's character, the tortured and trapped wife who had a spectacular home and sexy designer clothes. I could relate. Though I did try, it turned out that I was bound to be a beauty school dropout. Most of the girls in my class were really focused and had talent for the field. They were destined to do hair. Thankfully, I had another sweet destiny waiting for me, because I certainly would never be crowned queen of finger waves. I could have never imagined just a few years after my 500 hours with the Guidettes, I'd be at the altar with one of the most powerful men in the music industry, an Italian no less. I hadn't been looking for anyone romantically. I certainly wasn't looking for a husband, and I most definitely wasn't looking to marry Tommy, but it happened anyway. And what a happening it was. Once I said yes to the marriage, I thought, hey, we might as well make it an event, an extravaganza. As with any project or production I'm involved with, I wanted to bring as much optimism and festiveness to it as possible. Tommy was also enthusiastic about the potential pomp and circumstance we could create. He focused on curating the most influential and impressive audience, I mean guest list, he could. Clearly, there was no family or mother of the bride running the show here. Lord knows this task was way beyond anything my mother could ever comprehend. Besides, this wedding was designed to be an entertainment industry spectacle. Even a capable mother or sister couldn't manage the production we were going to put on. The wife of one of Tommy's colleagues, who was a socially well-connected middle-aged woman, was given the role of production coordinator. She helped me with all the major details, such as the dress. That dress was an event unto itself. My coordinator was friends with one of the most prominent female fashion designers of the era, whose specialty was bridal. It seemed like I spent as much time in her showroom for fittings as I did in the studio for an entire album. There were at least 10 fittings, crazy for a girl who, not so long before, had only had 3 shirts in rotation. Of course I was inspired by Princess Diana. Who wasn't? She was an inspiring figure. I loved that wedding, and really, it was my only reference point for how a wedding should look. I didn't grow up looking at bridal magazines, and besides, the royals knew how to throw a good wedding, obviously. In the end, nearly every princess element or symbol imaginable could be found in that dress. The cream silk fabric was so fine it seemed to glow. The sweetheart neckline swooped gracefully off the shoulder before blooming into exaggerated poof sleeves. The structured bodice was intricately encrusted with crystals and beads exploding into an enormous ball gown skirt, kept afloat by layers upon layers of crinolines. But the most notable feature was the ultra-dramatic 27-foot train, which required its own team of handlers. Affixed to a diamond tiara was an equally long veil. Sid Curry twirled my curls to tumble down like Rapunzel's, and Billy B did my face, serving up both glamorous ingenue and belle of the ball. I had come a long way from Cinderella of the shack. The bouquet was unforgettable, a cascade of roses and orchids studded with various all-white blossoms romantically tangled with vines of ivy. A small troop of little girls threw white petals at my feet. Tommy did not disappoint on his assignment either. The casting was impressive. The guest list included heavy hitters from Barbra Streisand to Bruce Springsteen, Billy Joel and Christie Brinkley, even Ozzy Osbourne and Dick Clark. To top it all off, his best man was Robert De Niro. Though my bridesmaids included my longtime and trusted friends Josephine and Clarissa, they brought me no comfort. No one could. I was deathly afraid. I hardly remember the ceremony at the majestic St. Thomas Church. We needed a venue that could accommodate the drama of the dress, after all. I remember our song was You and I, We Can Conquer the World by Stevie Wonder, because I chose it, of course. I recall my face shaking involuntarily at the altar. But the moment those church doors opened up onto Fifth Avenue, I heard the roar of screams and saw the hordes of fans flooding every inch of sidewalk as far as the eye could see, camera flashes popping like fireworks. I walked down the stairs and smiled at them. For me, my wedding wasn't for all those rich and famous people I barely knew. It wasn't for my distant, dysfunctional family, though I do fondly remember my grandfather, by then in the grips of dementia, lovingly yelling my name like he was on the block, Mariah, Mariah. To me, The wedding spectacle was mostly for the fans, and we gave them the fabulous moment they deserved. There was a star-studded reception at the Metropolitan Club. I liked the venue because it had MC monogrammed everywhere, but we didn't mention that to TM. That I barely remember. I was exhausted. It had taken so much energy just to plan the thing and then get through it. The night before, I'd had a girls-only sleepover at the Mark Hotel. I was clearly conflicted. My friends knew I didn't even really believe in the institution of marriage, and yet here I was about to put on this major show with a man who was already showing dangerous signs professionally and personally. He would become my next of kin. The stifling hot mess of a relationship that I was already in with him would only become more foul and imbalanced. "You don't have to do this," they all said, but I truly believed I had to. I saw no way out. I didn't know what else to do. I'd learned how to endure disappointment and carry on, to make the best of things and keep working. I certainly knew how to live with fear. I didn't know life without fear. Tommy and I pulled off the wedding. The next day, we flew to Hawaii. I can't, in good conscience, refer to what we did as a honeymoon. It was not sweet. It was not dreamy. At all. We were staying at someone's house, which was already pretty lackluster. I didn't really care that much since my relationship with Tommy was never about romance, but still, it was technically my honeymoon-ish. Thankfully, the house was on the beach, and being near the ocean is always a comfort to me. The next day, I had gone to the bathroom to change into a swimsuit when I heard Tommy ranting on speakerphone. I could tell he was arguing. Great. "What's the matter?" I asked. He was on the phone with his very high-powered publicist who was going ballistic, screaming and cursing because he didn't want our wedding photos on the cover of People as we'd planned. The publicist was telling Tommy that it wasn't appropriate for his executive image. His image? I mean, why go through all that grandiosity for some little corner picture, as the publicist was urging? I shared this opinion with him and Tommy. The publicist exploded. "Are you fucking kidding me?" he yelled at me. Tommy didn't come to my defense, so here I was, 20-ish, on my honeymoon-ish, with a 50-ish-year-old man screaming and cursing at me over the phone while my 40-ish husband sat there not doing a damn thing about it. And to top it all off, I was right. Of course our wedding should have been a big cover story. It was planned that way. This was show business. While the two angry men yelled at each other and me like children, I broke out crying and broke out of that house. I just started running aimlessly down the beach, tears streaming down my face. We hadn't even digested the wedding cake, and here we were again, back to bickering, back to raging, back to me being dismissed and outpowered. Nothing had changed or calmed down. I just ran, not knowing where I was going. Eventually, I came upon a hotel with a beachside bar. Perfect, I thought. I could use a drink. But when I sat down, I realized I had left empty-handed. I didn't have a phone or a purse, no cash, no card, no ID. I couldn't even get myself a sympathy drink to cry into. With my hair bunched up in a top knot, wearing nothing but a bikini and a sarong, I looked like 1,000 lonely young women on the beach, not like a famous pop star who had sold millions of records worldwide. I most certainly didn't look like a honeymooning bride. If anyone did recognize me, they left me alone, and no one could imagine how alone I felt. I asked to use the phone and made a collect call to my manager. Remember when you had to memorize important phone numbers? I asked him to give the bartender a credit card number so I could at least get a drink. I ordered some sweet and sorry frozen daiquiri. I sipped on it and listened to the waves crashing on the shore as the reality of the situation began to sink in. Eventually, I made my way back down the beach and to the house, but I knew the drill. Once again, Tommy and I would sit in silence after all was said and done. The little bit of hope I'd had that getting married would change him washed away like footprints in the sand. That was the day I began to hold my breath and resist the undertow of Tommy. Thanksgiving is canceled. And I missed a lot of life, but I'll recover. Though I know you really like to see me suffer, still I wish that you and I'd forgive each other, 'cause I miss you, Valentine, and really loved you. Petals. I called him T.D. Valentine. That was his stage name back in the day when he fancied himself a musician. He loved music, that much is true, and he found a way to have a lifelong affair with it. As I've said, our mutual love of music, ambition, and power was completely intertwined with our personal relationship. Music was the relationship, but try as we might, that couldn't make it a marriage. I sincerely believed in my heart I would be with Tommy forever. but my sanity and soul would not surrender to my heart, and the marriage swiftly began to harm me on an emotional and spiritual level. There was a popular mythology that I was some sophisticated gold digger who bagged a big-time hitmaker who was now bankrolling my princess lifestyle, that I was just sitting pretty on a throne in my $30 million mansion. The wedding certainly gave that illusion, and that's all it was, an illusion. If there was any perception of a fairy tale marriage or life, it was absolutely smoke and mirrors. The ironclad safety that Tommy provided from my family turned into an ironclad dungeon. The control and imbalance of power in our relationship accelerated. My manager was a childhood friend of his. His preferred security was the tough guy he idolized from his school days, even though I towered over him when in heels. Everyone whose job it was to look after me had deep connections to him. I was very young and inexperienced when Tommy met me. He knew so much more about a lot of things, especially the music business, but I knew some things he didn't know too, particularly when it came to trends and popular culture, which I suspect made him feel threatened. He seemed threatened by anything he couldn't control. Even the idea of me doing something he couldn't control would send him into an irrational tailspin. One prime, ridiculous example. Once, there was a copy of Entertainment Weekly on our kitchen table in Sing Sing. In it was a short piece wherein a writer mused about the idea of a modern remake of All About Eve, starring Diana Ross as Margot Channing and me as Eve Haddington. Genius! Of course I adored the original movie, not only for the glamour and the iconic performances, but also because Marilyn Monroe had a small but delicious part as Miss Caswell, a gorgeous, ambitious actress. Tommy read the article and got pissed. At me! Somehow he found a way to blame me for someone else's fantasy of casting me in a movie which didn't even have a love scene, for God's sake. As if he were an overbearing father or warden, his anger would permeate the house and rattle my whole being. I got in trouble. Yes, trouble, because I felt so infantilized by him, for the mere suggestion made by someone else of me doing something beyond his control. The gap between our tastes and instincts in music and pop culture was more divisive than the gap between our ages. In the late 80s and through the mid-90s, Uptown Records, led by the late and legendary Andre Harrell, was the label for R&B, hip-hop, and the hybrid that would become known as New Jack Swing. Uptown had Heavy D and the Boys, Guy featuring Teddy Riley, Jodeci, Mary J. Blige, and Father MC. Father MC's album was one of my favorites. Mary J. Blige was doing background vocals and hooks for him, and he would also feature Jodeci. Love. I would listen to them all the time. Tommy would watch me listening. He knew to pay attention to what I was interested in because he knew my ear and instincts were sharp, but I knew he couldn't feel it. He couldn't fully grasp its cutting edge. He never really believed in the enduring cultural power of hip-hop because he couldn't fully understand it. He thought it was a passing fad or a trend. One night, Tommy and I were out with a group of friends and major music executives in a beautifully lit dining room in an Italian restaurant that served unforgettable warm focaccia and was frequented by music industry illuminati. We were all seated around a big table. My friend Josephine was in from Sweden, and she and her new husband were among the guests, so it wasn't completely a work dinner, but at this point, my work, social, and personal lives were pretty much one and the same. Even our home had been largely designed for conducting business and impressing partners, though my contemporaries' main concern was where they could chill and smoke a spliff. Of all the lavish rooms available, no surprise, we preferred the studio. We would sometimes host big festive dinners there, some of which were both fun and fabulous, but they never felt like family. Nothing feels like family when you're under surveillance, which I always was. The mid-90s were an exciting era in music, and I was part of a pioneering generation of innovative young artists, songwriters, producers, and executives. We were intent on making a new kind of sound, based in R&B and rap, but unrestricted by old formats and formulas. We were playing with new technologies and irreverently blending fluid melodies with gritty hip-hop aesthetics and energy. The music we were making was raw and smooth at the same time, and we were the only ones who knew how to make it work. It was our sound, a reflection of our time and our sensibilities. My former manager was also with us at the restaurant. The conversation drifted to Puffy, a.k.a. Sean, a.k.a. P. Diddy, who had recently left Uptown Records, where he'd started as an intern, eventually becoming head of A&R. Now he already had his own record label, Bad Boy, and his star artist, the Notorious B.I.G., was all over the radio and beginning to spread all over a generation. The then head of Epic Records turned to me and asked, "So, what do you think of this guy Puffy? What do you think is going on with him? Do you like his music?" He directed the question to me because I was the youngest person at the table. I also loved and understood hip-hop, and I was the only artist there. Besides, I'd recently worked with Puff as a producer. The table got quiet as I leaned in and gave my honest assessment that Puff and Bad Boy were definitely where modern music was headed. Not too long before, at our kitchen table, Tommy had shared his own opinion with me and my nephew, Sean. Puffy will be shining my shoes in 2 years. I was stunned. Wait, what did he say? It was one of the very few times I stood up to Tommy, telling him that what he had said was blatantly racist. I was pissed. Sean had never seen me talk back to him. He was shocked that I showed my anger and became genuinely concerned for my safety. So many people were then. But that night at the restaurant, what could have been a robust discussion between industry leader and artist about global culture and the future of American pop music became an epic Tommy tantrum instead. As I was finishing my answer, I saw his eyes flash with familiar rage. He jumped up from the table and began pacing, huffing and puffing around the restaurant. He was so livid he couldn't contain himself. The entire table sat in silence as we looked at one another, not knowing what the actual fuck was wrong with him this time or what we should do. The whole restaurant witnessed Tommy trying to walk himself back down off a ledge only he could see. Finally, he stormed back. Still vibrating with rage, he slammed his fist on the table and announced, "I just want everybody to know that Thanksgiving is canceled." Okay. We were planning to have a festive Thanksgiving dinner party at Sing Sing, but because I had dared to give my honest, autonomous opinion in public to someone he admired who had asked me what I thought, he was going to shut down the fun. As if it were my 10-year-old birthday party. Even then, it was laughable, the hubris with which he declared a national holiday canceled. Like, who was going to call Frank Perdue? By God, who was going to recall all the butterballs? I'd been asked a direct question. What was I supposed to do? Sit there like a dummy and not answer the man? It was all just ridiculous. What wasn't funny was knowing how I would be punished for my transgression on the hour-long ride home. Something came over me that night, and I decided I wasn't going to take the hit for something that wasn't my fault again. This night, I would not be locked up in Tommy's Range Rover torture chamber and sent back to prison in Bedford. I decided I was not going to leave with him under any circumstances. I realized I was taking a huge, frightening risk, but because we were in a public place with a table full of witnesses, I took a gamble thinking he wouldn't make a bigger scene and I might be safe. He sat at the table stewing and staring at me. I perched nervously in my chair, my leg literally quivering under the white linen tablecloth, but still full of conviction. Somehow, I stared back. Not this night. There was no fucking way I was taking that car ride with him in that state. It was a tense standoff and everyone at the table was freaked out. They were scared for me. They were scared for themselves. Everybody was always scared of Tommy. But I held my position and finally, Tommy walked out alone. Even though he and I both knew there would still be people following me and reporting back to him, this stand was a monumental move on my part. Out of respect for our privacy, the chef and proprietor agreed to let me discreetly exit through the kitchen. Josephine and I went out to a little club, which was an enormous step for me, to shake it off and have a few cocktails. Then we went to a hotel to get a decent night's sleep. It was my first sip of freedom, and how thirsty I was for more.
'Cause it's my night, no stress, no fights, I'm leaving it all behind. No tears, no time to cry, just making the most of life.
It's like that. The night Tommy canceled Thanksgiving was the first time I stood up for myself and resisted his orders. He never allowed me to have a voice of my own. Exhibiting the slightest bit of agency or independent thought seemed to threaten and emasculate him. I had no control over his control. I was the voice of the label, making all kinds of profits and shares for him, and yet I couldn't have a voice at the dinner table. But I wouldn't allow myself to be canceled. Fantasy. While Tommy would never relinquish control over my life, at a certain point he did begin to make concessions when it came to the production of the music. He always respected me as a songwriter. He was a music man and knew good lyrics and melody structure. However, not only was I outgrowing some of the producers he had attached to me, so was the music industry. I always resisted their push to make me fit in a neat mainstream adult contemporary category. Adult contemporary was what he knew. It was what his guys knew, and I really knew it too. I could write big pop hits like Hero. I could write Broadway-style tunes. Whatever the occasion required, I could make it happen. But I wanted to make more of my own music with a more modern sound. They kept trying to smooth me out while I just wanted to get a little more rough. I wanted to add dynamics and broaden my reach. And, of course, there was a racial and cultural dimension that came with integrating hip-hop. It was a black art form. Unlike jazz, which Tommy appreciated, or gospel, hip-hop was radical, raw, and in-your-face. It was not designed to make middle-aged white men feel cool. Hip-hop didn't really need his kind of hit-maker anymore, and I think it threatened him by endangering his power. And yet, he couldn't deny the evidence. My instincts were making hits, so he stopped fighting me so much on the samples, artists, and producers I wanted to work with. I knew hip-hop added exciting, young energy to almost any other sound if done correctly. I knew Puff would be the perfect producing partner for the fantasy remix I was dreaming about. I was so happy with what producer Dave Jam Hall and I had done with the single. For the sample, I chose Genius of Love by the Tom Tom Club. It was a perfect, fun, swinging party song, but I knew it could go to even more interesting places. We kept the Tom Tom Club sample for the remix, even emphasizing and bringing it out further. Puff was pretty enthusiastic about my idea of featuring Old Dirty Bastard from the Wu-Tang Clan. That was the real Genius of Love. The suits at the corporate morgue weren't crazy about ODB. They actually thought he was certifiably crazy and that I was about to throw my entire fan base into shock. Tommy generally considered rap background noise and had no idea that ODB was about to bring the noise to fantasy. They didn't understand how diverse my fans were, nor did they understand the global impact of the Wu-Tang Clan. I mean, up from the 36th chambers, come on! Wu-Tang was a movement, a once-in-a-generation type of group, and ODB was such an extra special member. I truly believed he would bring something incredible to the remix. Puff got the vision and ran with it. There were also a couple of cool A&R folks who helped me smuggle in one of the greatest rap features of all time. Of course, the session for ODB was late in the evening, and after I was swooped up by Tommy and brought back to Sing Sing for the night. I had taken a bath, which had become for me a kind of reverse baptismal ritual by which I transitioned from young global recording artist back to caged Westchester wife. I slipped into a white silk nightgown, tiptoed across the white wool carpeting of the master bedroom, and climbed into our opulent bed, outfitted with thousand thread count white Egyptian sheets and what seemed like 100 white down pillows. Tommy was already in bed in his white cotton pajamas. His side of the bed seemed a million miles away. The sterility had become routine. Suddenly the phone rang. I answered and started to squeal with excitement. Someone from the studio called to report ODB had completed his session. Wait, I said. Let me put you on speaker. I pressed speakerphone for Tommy to hear.
Yo, New York in the house. It's Brooklyn in the house. Uptown in the house. Shaolin, are you in the house? Boogie Down, are you in the house? Sacramento in the house. Atlanta, Georgia, are you in the house? West Coast, are you in the house? Japan, are you in the house? Everybody, are you in the house? Baby, come on. Baby, come on.
Whee! I couldn't contain myself. I may have even started jumping up and down on the bed. Then I heard the next lines. Me and Mariah go back like babies with pacifiers. Old dirt dog, no liar, keeping fantasy hot like fire. That was it. Old Dirty Bastard spit crazy brilliance and scorched our pristine white bedroom with the grime and righteous fun I'd been craving. It kept going, and all his crazy ad-libs sent me into euphoric giggles. I reveled in it. I was just screaming and laughing and whooping. But then I looked over at Tommy. His head was cocked to the side with a look of confusion he couldn't contain. "The fuck is that?" he blurted. "I can do that. Get the fuck out of here with that." There it was. That was what he had to say about one of the most unique, amazing things I had ever heard. I think he was in shock, or maybe he did think he could do it, and that all of us were nuts. It was as if the Starship Enterprise had beamed me into another galaxy, far, far away from Tommy. Music was our only true bond, and now we were light years apart. Now, I was crazy about Fantasy Remix. It was one of the first of my songs that I played over and over before it was out on the radio. I played on the ride back to Bedford. I'm sure Tommy loved that. It felt like all the fun I had missed out on in my childhood. It made me feel happy. ODB's energy was something everyone could relate to. He was your loving, fun-ass uncle who gets drunk at all the festivities. At Christmas dinner, the cookout, Thanksgiving. ODB and Puff just really helped me create something enduring that all kinds of people connected to. That remix gave us lines and feelings we would use forever. He even brought back Donnie and Marie Osmond with I'm a little bit country, I'm a little bit rock and roll. Like, what made him just bust out and sing that? Genius. And now, when I'm singing it on stage and we have his vocals, it sounds like he's saying, I'm a little bit rock and roll. That always gets me. Making the fantasy video was really important to me, too. I wanted it to feel fun and carefree. In my opinion, which was so rarely considered, almost all of my videos weren't right. Tommy never allowed me to work with the directors I wanted, the hot ones at the time, like Herb Ritz or the cool fashion stylists who would bring an edge to my look. These were creative people he couldn't completely control. His package for me was so mainstream, but this one, there was no homogenizing this one. Necessity is the mother of invention, right? So, since I couldn't have a director I wanted to work with, I decided to direct the video myself. It was a simple concept, young, fun, and free. It was shot on location at Westchester's Playland Park in Rye, New York. Everyone can relate to the joy and abandon of an amusement park, the feeling of throwing your hands up in the air on the roller coaster. That's the pure fun I wanted to capture. Simple elements like rollerblading cute kids, bright colors, cut-off shorts, and a clown. There was a night dance sequence with a crew of fresh B-boys, and that was pretty much it. That was the pop version. For the remix video, I wanted ODB to do for the video what he had done on the song, bring a zany, grimy element to it. The day of ODB's shoot was overcast, and we had one simple setup for him on the boardwalk. I went into his dressing room for our first face-to-face meeting bearing a gift, a silver flask engraved with his initials. We talked over the concept, which again was pretty simple because I didn't want anything to overshadow his performance, as if it were possible for anything to upstage ODB. I told him about the idea of tying the clown up on the pole and really featuring his grills. He was down with all the action, but he had some kind of a problem with his wardrobe and wanted a wig. I want a wig, he kept saying, like one of them motherfuckers from the 60s, like Al Green. I'm like this generation's Al Green. Oh, I don't know about Al Green, but you definitely are something incredible, I respectfully responded. He was already in his full-blown drunk uncle mode. I had to send the stylist out to the mall with him so he could get exactly what he was envisioning. Mind you, we were in Westchester. It was my video, but I was still in Tommy's territory. When they returned, after an hour or two, the stylist was a wreck. Apparently, ODB was singing and shouting and whoa-ing and drinking all through the mall. But his look was perfect. The elongated and baggy proportions were just right for his dancing and weird, wonderful movements. He used his sleeves and his hood as props. It was spot on. And the scene where he's bare-chested in the straight mushroom wig with the pointy shades, he was giving a little more Ike Turner than Al Green, but whatever it was unforgettable. His performance was all him, and it was perfect. I know ODB had some real trouble on his soul, but he brought nothing but joy to the remix, to the video, and to my world. R.I.P. ODB. Fantasy was a big record. It was the first single to debut at number one on the Billboard Hot 100 in history by a female artist, and the second artist to ever do it. The first was Michael Jackson with You Are Not Alone. It held the top spot for 8 consecutive weeks and remained on the charts for a total of 23 weeks. It was my 9th number one single. Even the critics liked Fantasy and the remix, some really liked it. The entire Daydream album did amazingly well, certified diamond. As an album, it had some really special enduring singles like Always Be My Baby and, of course, One Sweet Day, whose lyrics and music I co-wrote with Boyz II Men, inspired by the passing of my incredible friend and collaborator, David Cole, and their tour manager, both of whom died too soon. One Sweet Day was the longest-running number one single in American history for 23 years. I was set to perform Fantasy and do some other bids at the 23rd Annual American Music Awards, where I was nominated in several categories. It was a big night for me, but winning the Best Female Pop Artist and Best Female R&B Artist Awards was not the most memorable moment for me. When I wasn't on stage or waiting in the wings, I sat in the front row next to Tommy. We were both outfitted in couture tension. the cover shoot of Daydream by photographer Steven Meisel, who was arguably the most prominent in the fashion industry at the time, set the look of the chic Black is the New Black style for the tone of the album's promotion. Ironically, my outfit for this performance was giving you pseudo-militant Mariah vibes with black leather pants, a black leather trench coat, and a black turtleneck. I'm sure Tommy liked it because the only skin exposed was my face. Maybe it was a premonition of what was ahead. Because I had more than just the fantasy performance to do that night, I had a trailer behind the Shrine Auditorium for wardrobe changes and such. I was returning to the trailer to get into another ensemble. Security was everywhere, so I didn't need to be followed for the short walk to where all the artist trailers were parked behind the theater. As I stepped out in a complete rush to get back to the stage, I noticed a white Rolls Royce quietly, slowly approaching. Just as my toes touched the asphalt, the gleaming, elegant vehicle came to a gentle stop right in front of my door. It was as if time itself had slowed to a stop. The tinted passenger window glided down. He was alone, leaning back in the driver's seat, so that the arm that gripped the leather steering wheel was nearly straight. He propped his head back just enough that his luxurious eyelashes didn't cast a shadow and obscure his alert and amazing dark eyes that looked into mine. "Hey, Mariah," he said softly, my name pouring out of his lips like smoke. Then that spectacular smile burst through everything. In an instant, the window went back up and Tupac rolled away. Had it not been for a production assistant or someone calling me back to the stage, back to Earth, I may have stayed there stunned for hours. I did my bit on stage and returned to my stiff seat next to Tommy. My heart fluttered nervously, but he didn't know. No one knew. I just had Tupac Shakur's eyes all on me. Though I was recording Daydream, parts of my life were still quite a nightmare. I was writing and singing upbeat songs like Always Be My Baby and sweeping ballads like One Sweet Day. I was totally inspired by the creative risk we took in collaborating with ODB on the Fantasy remix. I was exploring my musical range, but I was also filled with rage. It's always been a challenge for me to acknowledge and express anger. My personal life was suffocating during Daydream, and I was in desperate need of a release. Music and humor have been my two great releases. They have been how I survived all the anguish in my life. So, while I had a full band and studio time at the Hit Factory for that album, I created an alter ego artist and her Ziggy Stardust-like spoof band. My character was a dark-haired, brooding goth girl. A version of her, Bianca, showed up a few years later in the Heartbreaker video, who wrote and sang ridiculous, tortured songs. At the end of each session, I would go off to a corner and, without overthinking it, quickly scribble down some lyrics. In 5 minutes, I'd have a song. I am vinegar and water. I am someone's ugly daughter. I am wading in the water. And I am like an open blister. I am Jack the Ripper's sister. I am just a lonely drifter. I'd bring my little alt-rock song to the band and hum a silly guitar riff. They would pick it up and we would record it immediately. It was irreverent, raw, and urgent, and the band got into it. I actually started to love some of the songs. I would fully commit to my character. I was playing with the style of the breezy, grunge, punk, light, white female singers who were popular at the time. You know, the ones who seemed to be so carefree with their feelings and their image. They could be angry, angsty, and messy with old shoes, wrinkled slips, and unruly eyebrows, while every move I made was so calculated and manicured. I wanted to break free, let loose, and express my misery, but I also wanted to laugh. I totally looked forward to doing my alter ego band sessions after Daydream each night. Tommy was off in Italy a lot of the time, so I had a little space and air to do this bizarre, fun thing that was just for me. The band loved it, and we ended up with an album's worth of songs, which we mixed and everything. My jokey anger release project ended up being a weirdly good, satirical, underground, alternative rock thing. When Tommy and some of the other label folks heard it, they couldn't believe we had done all that while recording Daydream. I even got the art department at the label to design a cover I had conceptualized. I wrote the title with pink lipstick over a Polaroid picture Tommy had taken of a giant dead cockroach in Italy. I told them to add a smashed-up eyeshadow makeup palette. They laid it out, and it was perfectly grungy and cheeky. I got a lot of personal satisfaction out of making that alternative album. I made the sarcastic, hardcore, headbanging record no one was ever going to allow me to make. My assistant and I used to blast it in the car, riding up the back streets of Westchester, singing at the top of our lungs, giving me a brief moment to be outwardly angry, irreverent, and free. There was a song on the album called Crave that I eventually renamed Demented. Tommy knew I had a talent for recognizing talent, so he created a boutique record label for me that I named Crave, inspired by the song. The first act on the Crave label was a hip-hop group called the Negro League. They have cameos in the Roof video. They named themselves after famed black baseball players like Satchel Paige and Cool Papa Bell, who'd had to form their own league because of segregation. They were young, fun, and all of them were fine. I just loved rolling into a party with them. They would chant, Negroes, Negroes. Nothing ambiguous about that, darling. Later, when it became clear to Tommy that the marriage was not going to make it, Crave quickly became defunct and the alt album conveniently disappeared. There was one small, sweet residual benefit from Crave and the Negro League. I cast one of my friends from the group as my shirtless, motorcycle-riding, lip-licking love interest in Jermaine's Sweetheart video. I called him Flask, which was close to his name, because he was so nervous on the flight over to Bilbao, Spain, that he drank and got smashed. But his hangover played well on film, emphasizing his already dreamy eyes. He was my sweetheart for a very short time right after a very tough breakup, which I'll get into soon enough. He was fun, fine, and just the thing to lick my wounds.
One summer night, we ran away for a while.
In the wake of the success of the Fantasy remix featuring Old Dirty Bastard, I now had some ammunition that made it slightly easier for me to work with people outside of Tommy's jurisdiction. I was starting to reach out to what I thought were the right collaborators with whom I could achieve the sound I'd been hearing for a while, which included infusing hip-hop and working with a diversity of rappers. However, the old guard of A&R and music executives at the major labels didn't know how to control or contain hip-hop and looked at me sideways for my suggestions. Rap was making a lot of money really fast, so the smart execs raced to try and get a piece of it, and Tommy was no exception. He was smart. Though he'd always had a more traditional pop/adult contemporary style in mind for me, he couldn't deny that the industry and the audience were shifting. It was well established that Tommy didn't particularly like rap or rappers, but he was a shrewd businessman, and despite his initial resistance, he understood that I had my finger on the cultural pulse. I was determined for my next single to sound more like the music I was hearing in my head all day, the music I'd been dreaming of, so I began my work on Butterfly. I had gotten to a place where I was trusted to choose people I was inspired by, not the predictable players. One of the most talented was a suave and scrappy producer out of Atlanta with a brilliant ear and instinct, Jermaine Dupri. Like me, Jermaine got in the game early. He was fiercely ambitious and super talented. By the time he was 19 years old, he discovered, developed, written, and produced multi-platinum hits for Criss Cross and secured a joint venture deal for a record label, So-So Def Recordings, with Sony and Columbia. I was really inspired by the work he did on Just Kickin' It with the fresh girl group out of Atlanta, Escape. It was intentionally underproduced. His track choices were sonically raw, just what I was looking for. Once I heard that song, I knew we should work together. Jermaine, a.k.a. JD, a.k.a. Jermash, as I call him, and I instantly creatively clicked. As producers, we both had a fierce discipline in the studio, but we could also approach the music with abandon, unafraid to try new things. We could focus and flow together. It was a rare relationship, and we knew it. Our first collaboration was Always Be My Baby on Daydream. It was the first song we wrote together, but it was as if we'd done it a million times before. We sat in the studio and approached it like a blank canvas, sonically organic. With the gifted Manuel Seal on keyboards, we created this cool yet endearing classic song. In order to make the label happy, I had to deliver several versions of a single, including one that was up-tempo and simple, scrubbed of all ad-libs and, quote, urban inflections. In order to make myself happy and make sure a song I liked could work for the club kids who have always given me life, I set aside time to make remixes, sometimes several on one song. I often did complete rewrites and all new vocal tracks rather than recycling from the original, especially when I worked with David Morales. We would completely re-envision a song. We often worked late at night when I could steal a moment for myself. David would come to the studio and I'd tell him he could do whatever he wanted with the song. I'd have a couple splashes of wine and we would just go wherever the spirit took us, which were almost always high-energy dance tracks with big, brand new vocals. It was one way I found liberation while locked up in Sing Sing. I had a remix idea for Always Be My Baby and asked JD to bring Xscape and a big, exciting young female rapper out of Chicago named Brat, who had a hit record, Funkified, that JD had produced, to my studio. Knowing how smoothly JD and I worked together, I calculated that we could bang out a remix and shoot a cool docu-style video all in the same session. It was an efficient move. It was a very big feat to secure a hit record. You had to be strategic in your creative choices. We chose Tell Me If You Still Care by the SOS Band as the sample, thinking that it would be palatable for a crossover audience, and then having DeBrat rap on it would make it appealing for a hip-hop audience. JD was down. I knew how I wanted the remix to sound, with Supreme-style backgrounds. I had to redo all the vocals because it was in a different key, but because Jermaine was so adept in the studio and so in tune with all of our styles, I knew he could bring it all together. The session was set. So So Def was coming to Sing Sing. As you approach the grounds of Sing Sing, a security station sits to the right, obscured by trees. Inside were multiple screens connected to all the cameras throughout the house and on the property. JD made his way up the long driveway toward the enormous house that rose like a castle from a thick, fluffy blanket of glistening snow. He wasn't prepared for such grandeur. I didn't realize the rare air I was orbiting in until I caught that moment of recognition on JD's face when he stepped out of the car. The scale and opulence of the mansion suggested not simply music star, but the next stratosphere. Sing Sing was supersized. It was the physical representation of the combined power and influence of me and Tommy, a music industry power couple. And in that moment, we were the music industry power couple. When he got to the massive front door, Jermaine looked like Richard Pryor in The Wiz. Honestly, the whole lot of us looked like a group of children playing in a fairy tale kingdom, but in actuality, it was more like visiting day upstate. The joy was temporary. It was refreshing and a much welcomed reprieve to have a group of fresh artists at my house to create something we would love and respect. These were my peers, steeped in hip-hop music and culture, and we were down to make a hit. Though we were all very young, collectively, we were worth hundreds of millions of dollars in record sales. But once you walk through the gates of Sing Sing, that didn't mean much. We were now all under surveillance. JD, Xscape, and DeBrat took note of the excessive presence of bodyguards and security, but it wasn't immediately clear to them exactly who or what they were guarding. Jermaine was so focused and serious, he went straight to the studio to get acclimated and organized. He sat at the console in full command, like the captain of a spaceship. While he worked on the beat, the girls from Xscape and I vibed and talked through the mechanics of the background vocals. It was probably the first time I ever had five women close to my age at the house. Xscape was Candy Burris, Tamika Tiny Cottle, and Tamika and Latasha Scott. With their elaborate Atlanta hairstyles, glossy lips, and oversized sportswear, they were super fly and fully captured the glamorous yet chill look of women in hip-hop during those years. Their sound and style was exactly the right vibe for the remix and video. I wanted us all to look easy and real, not manipulated by development executives. From the studio, you could see the massive French windows, which led to the indoor pool area with its museum-like high ceilings. On clear days, the reflection of clouds would float on the water's surface from the outdoor pool, which was beyond the walls. From the outdoor pool, you could see the pond, and from there, on a clear night, you could catch the twinkling lights of Manhattan way in the distance. We hung out in the marble room at the pool, playing cards, drinking, cracking jokes, almost like actual girlfriends. And then there was DeBrat. Her energy was irresistible. I adored her instantly. I was very reserved around new people back then. I had become shy, and it took me a long time to trust. It still does. But Brat broke right through the wall of my fearful past on day one. We had kindred, childlike spirits, only Brat fearlessly flaunted her little girl's soul while I was desperately hiding mine. A lot of effort, strategy, and money went into creating my classic storybook princess facade, but Brat, with all her irreverent adolescent spirit, armed in a big puffy coat and little braids and barrettes, burst right through my bubble. By this point, my life was so controlled by Tommy and his cronies, I could barely see it anymore. But Brat, with her spontaneity, brashness, and cool-assness, spotted my inner little girl right away and shook her awake. Brat was from the west side of Chicago and was clearly mesmerized by the extraness of Sing Sing. There was absolutely no posturing from her. She walked right in the door like, damn! I took her on a tour of the house. She never tried to contain her wonder as we ran from room to room, but we were not alone. Security was always there behind us, like a shadow. When we moved, they moved. For the past 4 years, I had been constantly working on such an intense level. I had so many decisions to make, so many people counting on me and looking to me for answers and a payday. If I had any free time, I spent it with Tommy or people his age, people on his payroll. I hadn't had any real fun in such a long time, and DeBrat was a one-woman party. I just wanted to have fun, but I knew we were being watched and listened to. There were cameras and recording devices throughout the house. I wasn't sure where they were all planted, but I knew of at least one place they weren't. Our next stop on the tour was the master bedroom. Brat was so funny. She squealed when she saw the giant television screen rise, as if by a magic trick, from a case at the foot of our elaborate bed. Brat was no girly girl. She was wearing oversized jeans, a polo shirt, and Timberland boots. But I made a big deal out of showing her my Coco Chanel-inspired closet and insisted she see my massive fancy shoe collection. I knew if I could get her in the shoe room, security wouldn't see us. I designed it and was pretty sure there were no cameras or listening devices among my Manolos. I chatted loudly about stilettos as I slowly closed the door. We sat on the floor of my shoe closet and kicked it for a bit. We were both Aries, both super silly, and both believed in an awesome God. I was having so much fun with Brat, but I knew we couldn't stay hidden for too long. Surely security would get suspicious and expose my one safe room in the house. I never knew who was listening, so I whispered to Brat, "Wanna go get some French fries?" In any other reality, this would have been a mundane suggestion, but in mine, it was about to be a full-scale caper. As we emerged from the closet, I put my finger to my mouth and pointed at the wall, giving her the signal to be quiet and follow my lead. I chirped on about showing her around the rest of the property, then announced that I wanted to quickly show her the cars. We skipped along to the garage. Inside, there was a fleet of cars. Several of them were mine, most of which I never drove, in part because I was always being driven. I pointed at the black Mercedes convertible and told Brat to get in quickly. I always kept the keys inside the car, so in a matter of seconds, I had the engine going. I threw it into gear, and we whipped around the cul-de-sac, then sped down the driveway and out onto the open road. Suddenly, there I was, flying down the street in my sports car with my new, cool homegirl, laughing deep and loud in the bright, wintry afternoon sun. It was exhilarating. Brat and I had broken out the big house. While we were out playing Black Thelma and Louise, Escape from Alcatraz was not playing so well back at Storybook Manor. I understood that security was necessary, but why was it necessary for them all to be white with blue eyes and black guns? They were going berserk. Before we got the mile or so down the road to the Burger King, Brat's phone began to ring. I could hear JD yelling on the other end, "Yo, Brat, get the fuck back here. They're going crazy." Brat laughed into the phone and replied, "I ain't driving, Mariah is." But JD was clearly upset. "This ain't fucking funny," he said. "Tommy is bugging out. He got everybody running around looking for y'all, and they got guns out and shit." Brat shot back, "Damn, we just going to get French fries, JD. If Mariah wants French fries, we getting fucking French fries." She abruptly slammed her phone shut, and we proceeded to Burger King. For the 20 or so minutes while Brat and I sat in the car eating those French fries and cracking jokes, I reveled in the simple excitement of being young. I'll never forget it. Jermaine must have called every 5 minutes begging us to come back. He went from being angry and annoyed to being nervous to being afraid. Brat was quickly realizing how serious our momentary escape had been. With every ring, she looked at me with increasing concern and sadness. We were really only a mile away, and people were panicking. She said something like, "This ain't right. This is your shit, Mariah. Jermaine, Escape, we all here because of you. You done sold millions of records, girl. You live in a damn palace. You have everything. But if you can't be free to go to fucking Burger King when you want, you ain't got nothing. You need to get out of there." This time, she wasn't laughing. If DeBrat, a 19-year-old female rapper from the West Side, is afraid for you, you know the situation has got to be dire, darling. When we pulled up to the property, there were more than 10 security personnel standing outside preparing two large black SUVs to go on a search. They stopped me before I could get up the driveway to the garage, as if I was a fugitive crossing the border. I was promptly whisked back into the house and back into the studio, back into my tower, my jail. JD was visibly shaken. My spontaneous, mischievous little scheme had had real consequences for him. I hadn't brought my phone, so security had no way of contacting me. There would be hell to pay from Tommy for such sloppy surveillance. While Jermaine was in the studio, concentrating on laying down the beat for the track, security had busted in and interrogated him with their guns out in broad daylight. I assume they figured that since Jermaine was the producer, Brat was his artist, so he was in charge. He was responsible. They yelled at him, "Where is she? Tell us where she is." Of course he had no idea where we were. He was working. He was at my studio. This was the first time he'd been at my house. He was only 23 years old. After Tommy was assured of my safe return, the situation settled down. Brat rolled a fat blunt, but God knows she couldn't smoke it around me, so she just held on to it throughout the shoot like a security blanket and began to work on her rap for the remix. Her nerves were a bit of a wreck now, too. In addition to everything else, she probably felt guilty we had caused such drama while recording her first big rap feature with me. But when the mic was hot and the camera was rolling, DeBrat killed it. Her delivery was happy and hard, playing with clever references and sophisticated rhythms inside the space of the song.
Who rocks your music box and break down your structure? You fantasize as you visualize me as your dream lover. Fuck with your emotions, unplug in your daydream.
Always Be My Baby remix. We got it done. A remix, a video, and a prison break all in one day. You would never know from the video I directed that we were surrounded by armed security. I was a master at editing out the pressure. Side effects. I was a girl, you were the man. I was too young to understand. I was naive, I just believed everything that you told me. Said you were strong, protecting me. Then I found out that you were weak, keeping me there under your thumb because you were scared that I'd become much more than you could handle. Shining like a chandelier that decorated every room inside the private hell we built. And I dealt with it. Like a kid, I wished I could fly away, but instead I kept my tears inside because I knew if I started, I'd keep crying for the rest of my life with you. I finally built up the strength to walk away. Don't regret it, but I still live with the side effects.
Side effects.
When Tommy suggested we go to couples therapy, I was surprised. Unsurprisingly, he told me it would have to be with his therapist, who he had been seeing for years. Nevertheless, this was a monumental step for both of us. Our careers and consequently our marriage were constantly in the public spotlight, but no one had ever been allowed into the dark interior of our relationship. I'd never had anyone to confide in about how I was living or not living. I had carried the burden of believing that because I was able to write, sing, and produce my songs, become famous, and gain access to unimaginable wealth, I didn't deserve personal happiness, too. I truly believed everything good in my life would cost me, and that Tommy's control was the price for my success. Honestly, I was really only trying to gain 5 minutes of peace, the opportunity to be able to walk down the stairs into my own kitchen to grab a bite to eat without the hiss of the intercom and his menacing, "What are you doing?" buzzing out of it. Also, I didn't trust anyone. By then, I was estranged from my immediate family, and everyone around me was connected to Tommy and scared of him. I knew that anything I said would get back to him, and I would suffer his constant rage. I had started to develop hives like breakouts. I went to see the dermatologist, who assured me that my otherwise unblemished skin was having a reaction to severe stress. It was suggested I make some dietary changes and add a few new cleansing routines to help soothe the symptoms. When I told Tommy the doctor's diagnosis, it was not good business for your top-selling artist to be hived out. He barked back, "Stress? Fuck you gotta be stressed about. Lord, let me count the ways." Therapy was a lifesaver. Our therapist was a kind, older Jewish woman with short amber hair and alert eyes. She had a cozy office in her classic Westchester home. I liked her more than I thought I would, as I assumed she would be on Tommy's team, but she was refreshingly impartial and a real pro. And he respected her, which was a major thing. At that point in my life, I didn't have many relationships with stable, professional adults whose livelihoods weren't connected to my record sales. There were very few places where I wasn't overcome with anxiety. First, there had been the recording studio, and now there was the therapist's office. Though even in my safe spaces, Tommy's presence would infect the atmosphere. I would be in the recording studio writing and vibing with producers or other artists, and he would often crash in at 6 or 7 p.m. to pick me up, as if I were his 9-to-5 office girl and not a recording artist who had her own creative process, which you couldn't place on a timer, not to mention who collaborated with various rappers and hip-hop producers, many of whom, like me, don't recognize time, especially daytime. As soon as he walked in, tension would eclipse the lightness of creating, all laughing would cease, and we'd all shrink a little to make room for the pressure that accompanied him. And while I can't say I felt completely safe or equal in the therapist's office or anywhere, it was the closest thing we had to a neutral space where Tommy and I could attempt to communicate. It was a profound breakthrough for me that she listened to both of us objectively, and she believed me. She had been treating him for years, like Tony Soprano and Jennifer Melfi, except she was more mother figure than sexy scholar. She might have been the only person who had some kind of insight into his psyche and could completely conceive of the repressive and paranoid conditions he imposed on me in our marriage and home life. She was the first to recognize and name the abuse I was living under. I already knew the havoc it was wreaking on my spirit, but she identified the damage it was doing to me emotionally. After some of our sessions, she would ask Tommy to go sit and wait for me in the car so that she and I could decompress and speak honestly. Once, during our alone time, I asked her, pleading really, why can't he just let me go to the spa or to the movies or do anything? I did nothing wrong. She took a pause and said in her dry, matter-of-fact New York accent, "Sweetie, it's not normal. Why are you acting as if you're dealing with a normal situation?"